Yes, I think we're all familiar with that old saying about the only two certainties in life, death and taxes, and we probably avoid them where we can, or at the very least, we endure them. I'm joined now by two men who would like to change our perception of tax. It's not dry, they say. In fact, tax has a rich and colourful history, and it holds lessons for tackling some of the thorniest problems we face today, like inequality and climate change. Michael Keynes, the Deputy Director of the Fiscal Affairs Department at the IMF, the International Monetary Fund, and Joel Slemrod is a Professor of Economics at the University of Michigan. And together they have laboured long to produce a book which has been much acclaimed, titled Rebellion, Rascals and Revenue, Tax Follies and Wisdom Through the Ages. What a title, gentlemen. Welcome.
Thank you.
Thanks for having us. Yeah, no, we're proud of the title. Yeah.
It sure does suggest an exhilaration about this topic, which you don't have to persuade me, but you probably do have to persuade rather a few people. How far back does the history of tax go, and why do you think it's important to have an appreciation of this history? First to you, Michael, or Mick, as I think you prefer to be called.
Yeah, no, it's great. Well, thanks, first of all, for having us and for sharing your enthusiasm. Yeah, so it goes back pretty much as far as everything goes back in terms of written records. We have, going back to ancient Sumer, we have clay tablets that are about taxation. We have Egyptian wall paintings about taxation. And the Rosetta Stone, which enabled the kind of us to understand hieroglyphics, was all about taxation. So it goes back as far as written records, and doubtless even further than that. But why it's important? Well, partly is just shaped everyday lives of ordinary people for millennia. We often think that it's kind of our period that has suffered from high taxation, but really going through history, time has been even harder for many people through the ages. And in the process of interfering with people's everyday lives, it's really shaped our relationship with government. And that feeds in very much even to our national myths about ourselves and who we are. So I'm British, but I'm very aware that in America, for example, you know, the Boston Tea Party is a large part of what America is about, even though it turns out, as we explain in the book, that the Boston Tea Party was actually about a tax cut that the Americans didn't much like. So it's been with us, shaped our lives for so long, continues to do that. It's important too, we think, because people need to protect themselves against vested interests. And there are all kinds of special groups at play when it comes to thinking about taxation, trying to kind of hoodwink us as to who's going to really end up paying the tax and what good or bad the tax will do. To pick up one of your examples about death and taxes. So in the US, really a very successful campaign against the estate and gift tax ran by calling it a death tax, you know, aligning the tax with two things people hate most. So we think, you know, people need to be on the guard against being hoodwinked by special interests, which means really thinking a little bit more about tax than we often do. And finally, of course, as you say, tax is actually not boring. There are all kinds of weird and bizarre and outrageous and terrible things that have happened over the centuries in relation to tax. So as you say, basically the message of our book is tax isn't boring.
Quite. And one thing, Joel, that does strike me as really fascinating is the intersection between tax and war. And you write that taxation has been both the product and the progenitor of violence. Plunder generates resources that enable more plundering. So develop that idea, please, Joel.
Thanks for having us on. A famous political scientist once said that war made the state and the state made war. And that sums up what is a very, very close relationship over history between war and tax systems. It is the vast need of revenue to wage war that has spurred governments to raise tax rates of existing taxes, to enact new taxes, and to streamline tax collection. The what we're now think of as second nature, which is employer withholding of taxes on the employees, that only came in during World War II in the U.S. and the U.K. and other countries because of the vast need for more revenue quickly and the ease it provided the government in collecting revenue from a much smaller number of employers than it would be to have to collect from all the employees. And many combatant countries in both World War I and World War II, levied excess profits taxes, which are being brought up again today. And another link between war and taxation that is important and fascinating is the sense that the burden of war fell largely on the working and middle class fueled calls for highly progressive tax systems after the war. This was true in World War I and especially true in World War II. The men and women who lost their lives and their limbs were drawn from the broad population. And after the war, it was felt that the tax system should be highly progressive so that at least the burden of tax, if not war, was shared more equitably than otherwise. Gee. After World War II and the vast need for revenue, the top tax rates on income, individual income tax rates, stayed over 90% for almost 20 years after the end of World War II until the early 60s in both the UK and the US. In the present day, in the COVID pandemic, some people made reference to it as a war against the virus. And many people thought that that same sense might lead to highly progressive taxes. Some people called them solidarity taxes. I think we haven't yet seen that happen, but I think the link is there.
Well, that's so interesting. In other words, they're full of values, and then it's a sort of extrapolating from that, the politics that emerges from that, which I don't think people do grasp by and large. I mean, Mick, just the personal income tax levied, first of all in Britain, wasn't it? And then it went beyond. Now, can I just say one of the reasons I'm fascinated by is I was in the UAE in the early noughties and watching them, because there's no personal income tax or hasn't been in a lot of the Arab countries, and that it's a huge discussion as to how you do that, how you levy a personal income tax. It was quite a revelation to me.
Yes, that's right. As well, as you say, the income tax really goes back to the Napoleonic Wars in England, and I think picked up again in many countries in the First World War. I think maybe wrong, wasn't the first federal income tax in Australia? I think it was something like 1915. But it's true, many countries still struggle with the idea of an income tax, maybe preferring sort of counterintuitively in terms of what many other countries do, sort of going almost first for the value-added tax before going for the personal income tax.
Yeah, I suppose it's that whole idea of fundamental to the democracy. Well, modern economies as we now sort of know them really have personal income tax, I think, very much embedded in them. Look, we tend to think, though, I think of taxes as purely about generating revenue, but they've also been used as a tool to change behaviour, haven't they, Joel?
Oh, absolutely. In the book, we tell historical stories about tax, which might seem bizarre at first, but have analogs today. And one of our favorite stories is the beard tax of Peter the Great when he decided to modernize Russia to look more like England and France. He took it literally when it came to the nobility, which in Russia had these long big beards, and that was not the style in France and England. And so what did he come up with? Oh, a tax on beards, a beard tax. If you were a noble and you were in public, you had a beard, you had to display a token that showed you'd paid your tax. Now, it probably raised some revenue, but the idea behind the beard tax was to induce the nobles to shave their beards so they would look more modern in Peter's eye anyway. And throughout history, there have been taxes which are exactly designed to change behavior more than raise revenue.
Oh, tell us about the bachelor taxes. I mean, that's really amazing.
Many countries have had bachelor taxes. Some U.S. states have had bachelor taxes. And
what are they?
You can think of a justification for it. You might argue that, well, bachelors don't have a family to support, so they can afford a higher tax. And one of our favorite stories from the book is a classic example of the kind of avoidance techniques that arise in tax systems. So some countries that had bachelor taxes had a provision which said, well, if you're a bachelor and you tried to get married, but you couldn't find someone who would agree to marry you, you were exempt from the tax.
Is that true?
In Argentina, apparently what happened is that there was a profession born called professional lady rejectors. For a fee, they would sign a document saying you had indeed asked them for their hand and they had refused.
Obviously, the purpose of this was to, well, I presume the purpose was to commit people to the production of the next generation of people. I presume that's what it was all about. And also, yes, there was a sort of a bias towards family formation. Was that the idea?
That was the idea. And these somewhat bizarre taxes, though, have a modern, very serious equivalent, which is taxes to deal with climate change, such as a carbon tax. Mm-hmm. Yes, it might raise a lot of revenue, but the primary objective is to get businesses and individuals to change their behavior to economize on fossil fuels. Tax on cigarettes, which raises a lot of money in a lot of countries, I think is a bit of both. Some people are for it because they think it will reduce smoking, which is bad for you and bad for the fisc. But in some countries, it now raises so much revenue that you can see governments sort of stepping away from anti-tobacco regulation because they're afraid of what it's going to do to their tax rate.
That is very interesting. Let me tell listeners that Michael Keane and Joel Slemrod are my guests, and they've written a book, and they're entertaining us, about tax through the ages, rebellion, rascals, and revenue. Now, one of the most conceptual and challenging questions this book raises, Mick, is how do you make a tax system both fair and efficient? Now, how would you answer that? Is it even possible?
Well, that's really, I guess, the biggest question of all, and that it's the one that kind of emperors and pharaohs and princes have struggled with throughout the ages, because you want a tax to be efficient in the sense that it doesn't kind of destroy economic activity too much and kind of destroy the goose that lays the golden egg, as it were. But even if governments don't particularly care about fairness in itself, they want it to be fair enough that their own government's going to survive, that they're not going to find their own heads stuck on pikes or something at the end of the day. So it's the core issue, really. And we know if we wanted a really efficient tax, and that was all we cared about, then things would be pretty straightforward. We'd just have a tax that was a what we call a poll tax, the same amount for everybody. Because if it was the same for everyone, you know, there'd be nothing you could do to avoid or ideally even evade the tax. But, of course, you want something that is a little bit tied to some notion of people's ability to pay. And the history of the last millennia have lots of examples of how governments have tried to do this. I mean, one of our favorites is that in medieval England and France, there were taxes that were based on your social class. So if you're a duke, you paid this much. If you're an earl, you paid a little bit less, and so on, right down the social chain. And that, you know, has some quite nice properties. Society got a bit more complicated, didn't work. Governments have tried things like taxing windows, which may sound kind of bizarre and quaint, but actually makes some sense in terms of something observable related to people's ability to pay the tax. And we sort of now we have the income tax, maybe the wealth tax people talk about. Who knows where we'll be in the future? Maybe we'll have other ways of assessing people's inherent ability to pay. But part of the problem with the fairness angle, of course, is that no one's really going to ever agree on what exactly is fair. We might have a reasonably scientific sense of a tax that's efficient, but there's never going to be full agreement on whether, you know, what we're trying to achieve in terms of fairness. The other thing, of course, is that it can be misleading just to look at the tax system in terms of fairness, because the tax is there to finance something, including the welfare provision that you mentioned earlier. So in some sense, one has to look at the whole package. It's kind of not necessarily right to say, well, the VAT or the GST is regressive and unfair if what it's going to finance is actually pretty progressive.
Yeah, but it's interesting, even the terms, you know, progressive and regressive, which I think were much more used when I was sort of growing up, and now they're avoided. And we used to have a great line here in Australia. It was a classic thing, you know, you want Kerry Packer, you know, the late Kerry Packer.
Oh, yeah.
Kerry Packer paying the same amount as the bloke who does his lawns. That's not fair.
Right, which,
so
right.
There was all summed up in that little interchange.
Yeah, and I think now we also focus on other aspects of fairness, sort of as between genders, even kind of as between racial aspects of taxation. So there are kind of more, all other dimensions of fairness, I think, maybe becoming more prevalent as concerns than they were.
Yeah, and Joel, I mean, How much revenue, another very thorny question, should governments raise? Where is that discussion now? Is there a baseline that's needed to have a reasonably well-run state?
The right way to think about it is not really how much revenue should governments raise, but how much should governments spend? That's the way to think about this question. How much should government be involved in finance, healthcare, education, defense? And then, once that's settled, over time, a government should, and indeed, in some sense, must raise about the same amount that they spend. And it's back to what Mick said. Of course, there's a connection between the two sides of government, what they're spending and what they're raising. You ask if there's a minimum amount of revenue for a reasonably well-run state, and it's hard to know, but it seems like some of the bulwarks of a good society, healthcare, education, a safety net, these things are naturally, not inevitably, but naturally provided by government. So I do think there's a minimum amount of tax to provide for the kind of government spending needed for a prosperous and fair society.
You do say today's average tax to GDP ratio is about one-third, 30%, say 33% in developed countries, although the tax ratios are quite low in developing countries, usually less than 15%. So, Mick, that does say rather a lot.
Yes, it does. I think there's certainly a kind of a very, very general rule of thumb when we think about low-income countries that 15% of GDP is kind of something that countries might aim at. Although, of course, there's a lot of uncertainty around that. But there is this notion that you need to be above 15 to kind of sustain the kind of government that has a reasonable prospects of securing the minimum sort of standard of living we'd like. And there are lots of, as you say, there are lots of countries that are still below that. And when we think, for example, about the ambitiousness of these sustainable development goals, which are these standards of well-being that governments in principle have committed to meeting worldwide by 2030, we're a long way off being able to finance those. And that's a major issue in these countries, is how to get the tax ratio up.
Well, that's perfect segue about tax evasion and tax havens, or you call them tax heavens, as you. There has been a recent development on this front at the recent G20 summit in Rome, where leaders of the world's 20 biggest economies endorsed a global minimum tax on big multinational businesses. Now, I presume, Mick, that really pleased you. Do you think it'll have an effect?
Well, I think it's certainly a really historic agreement, in the sense that we've had this system of international corporate tax for like 100 years or so, and that's kind of was clearly becoming outdated. So it's important in that there are new principles introduced into the system that even a few years ago you couldn't kind of talk about in respectable tax society. And one of those, as you say, is the idea of a minimum tax. Now, the immediate impact may not be that great. Most of the kind of revenue assessments are relatively not game-changing. So I think, in a way, the interesting question is going to be whether this deal will kind of survive. Now, we've kind of maybe opened a bit of a Pandora's box in accepting these new principles. So there are many people who say, for example, that, you know, a minimum rate of 15% may be better than nothing, but it's still, to many people, very low. Of course, others think it's very high. So I think the question is whether the principle of the minimum tax and this other principle that multinationals will now, to some degree, pay tax in a country simply if they sell there or if they're active there, if they have customers there, which is not the accepted principle up till now. Before, to pay corporate tax in a country, you actually kind of had to have feet on the ground in some sense. So I think the question is where it's going to lead, given too it's a very complicated system.
Yeah, look, finally, Joel, what other big challenges do you think tax systems face?
Let me just quickly add that these multinational agreements that we just had are an example of how things can change quickly in taxation. In history, we know the U.S. had no income tax till 1913, but by 1917, we had a 77% top rate. In 1960, there was no value-added tax. Now, 160 countries have it, and it raises a third of all revenue in the world. Looking forward, in your question, there's a lot of challenges. There is, in many countries, such as the U.S., a long-term fiscal imbalance, meaning that we've promised spending largely for elderly people, but not only, we've promised spending that far outweighs the taxes in place. And that's going to get only worse as populations age. The COVID-related debt has made the problem even worse. And so these problems suggest that taxes should probably go up, or government should rein in its promises, or maybe some combination of the two. But in most countries, maybe all countries, it's clear that it's not easy to raise taxes. In the U.S., the Biden administration set out to raise substantial revenue while shielding all but about the top 1% from more tax, and that is proving to be exceedingly difficult. Add in the very large inequality and growing inequality in many countries means that tax in the future has a lot of problems to deal with.
To paraphrase a former Prime Minister here in Australia, Paul Keating, this is the debate we have to have. Look, thank you both very much indeed for that skip through a really fascinating history, I think. Joel Slemrod and Michael Keane, thank you.
Thanks for having us.
Thanks, Jordy. Thanks very much.
And Michael and Joel's book is Rebellion, Rascals and Revenue, Tax Follies and Wisdom Through the Ages, published in Australia by New South Books.